This evening, our primary concern will be a consideration of the solar system as it has descended to us in the spiritual traditions of the great religions and philosophies of the world. The solar system has always been, at least partly, comprehensible. Peoples of different times have interpreted the mystery of it according to their own degree of insight. But certain astronomical phenomena were discovered at a comparatively early date. And while it was not until a few hundred years ago that our present astronomical pattern came into general acceptance, there is no doubt that ancient man intuited a great deal of what we call the modern science of astronomy. He probably could not pass a test according to our present standards, but he may also have possessed what modern astronomers do not have, and that is the inward experience of a living universe. To most modern people, even though they may actually deny the literalness of the statement, to most of them, the solar system in which we live is at best only an environment. It is a place larger than the back 40 acres of 19th century agriculturists, but still a place. It was merely an area in which things could happen. And whatever things were likely to happen were associated with planets, luminaries, asteroids perhaps, meteors, and finally the sovereign leadership of the sun. The solar system was a wonderful and magnificent kind of machine. Where it came from, we could abstractly speculate. That it must ultimately be dissolved in some final combustion, we can also assume. There is also a parallel line of thought in which it is going to become colder and colder until it becomes impossible to exist within it. All these rather melancholy concepts, however, are separated from our present thought by countless millennia yet to come. These things are for the remote future. The solar system as we see it is therefore our house. And from a very early time, men began to think of it as a temple, a tabernacle, a shrine. Pythagoras referred to the sun as a flaming altar around which the chariots of the gods were driven in their orbits, what we would call planets. The early church was not so very different in its speculations on these matters. At some comparatively ancient time, man also sensed that there was more to planets than he had first imagined. The belief that they were some kind of deities he held even anciently. They were sparks of light in the sky, and observations from the great astronomical towers or ziggurats on the plains of Babylon revealed that planets moved more rapidly than stars. So to them was given the term the wanderers. They moved in some remarkable procession around the sovereignty of the sun. This was not entirely understood, but they did move, and they had orbits. And even several thousand years ago, men calculated these orbits with some accuracy. Probably at first, the most practical purpose was divination. Astrology, sometimes called the mad mother of astronomy, had come into being. Almost equally useful was the development of an accurate calendar. Men liked to know how to record the seasons and time, and finally durations of ages. Not only was the calendar highly advanced in Asia and the Mediterranean area, but it was well advanced on the Western Hemisphere, especially in Central America. When the Spaniards came here, they corrected their own calendar from the calendar of the Maya. Thus, astronomy was always a more or less sacred science. It was part of the priestly prerogative, and all priests were supposed to know about the motions of the stars and to be able to predict the changes of seasons, and in Egypt, the inundations of the Nile. The solar system also began to intrigue another type of thinker, the analogist. And nearly all ancient science was analogical. The scientists sought to establish parallels between simple things easily known and more difficult things which are hard to understand. And he began to think of the solar system as a living body. He began to think of it as some kind of an organic structure. And he sought to find parallels in the physical body of man, some way of creating a key to the interpretation of universals from man, or perhaps a key to understanding man from a study of universals. This particular aspect was rather highly advanced by the old Kabbalists, and their findings descended as part of the heritage of early Christian mysticism. The Kabbalists, we may say, devised the concept that the solar system was a great person, a macrocosmic being, and that this great person, who was called Macroprosophos, was an organic living thing, that the planets represented the organs within the living body of this power. The sun was the heart. This body was also composed of flesh and of bones. Not only were these flesh and bones taken from the physical structures of planets, the rock was bone. The flesh was herbage and vegetation. But it was also believed that an arterial circulation existed within the body of this greater being. Energy moved in courses like great streams descending from the sun. Energy did not simply dissipate itself in an infinite diffusion. It was actually distributed by some kind of a mysterious arterial or venous system. And in order to provide some kind of an attenuated substance in which this energy might flow without being dissipated, our ancient brethren developed the concept of ether as an invisible element, as a hypothetical medium by means of which forces and energies, otherwise irreconcilable, could be brought together in a common state or condition. To the alchemists, the solar system was a kind of tree which grew up, and the planets became the symbols of the sacred metals and the various chemicals used in the preparation of the wise man's stone. The planets were also elements of a great theory of medicine in China. In India also, the planets and their orbits provided the key for music and the musical modes. And nearly all Chinese and other Oriental instruments are arranged according to a concept of planetary interrelationships. Pythagoras had the same concept when he broke the monochord, or the single string with frets, and arranged these frets according to the old concept of the planetary orbits. In all, the solar system became a kind of general source of analogical knowledge. Today we are inclined to think that this is all more or less a superstition. We are loath to admit that we might be living within a vast cellular organism. But the more we study cells and molecules and atoms and electrons and ions, the more it becomes evident that there are analogies between the solar system and the minute structures which make up the mass of matter as we know it today. We are also becoming more aware of the fact that there is no such a thing as any inert substance. Everything is living material, made up of life, and therefore it would hardly be proper to think of the solar system anymore as dead. It would be better to think of it as a vast area of life, perhaps an area of seminal life, that is, life in the form of seed life, which could, under certain conditions, unfold its own potential, and from each seed might spring another solar system in the course of infinite ages. The Hindus, of course, did not like to think of a solar system wandering around lonely in space, so it proceeded, the Hindu proceeded to populate space with an innumerable family of such solar systems. They might differ in detail, they might vary in size, but they were a kind of creation, just as man is a kind of creation. And as this type of creation may have many subtypes, so in the solar system pattern, there could be many different solar systems. And as the sun ruled in sovereignty over its planets, so it was assumed that a certain number of solar systems formed also a pattern, and that in the midst of these was a larger or universal sun, around which many solar systems moved. These solar systems, moving around this sovereign sun, also constituted units. Therefore, a cosmic system was merely a larger type of cell with suns taking the place of planets, and each sun surrounded by its own worlds. All these universal systems also grouped around greater centers, which might be likened to cosmic suns. And these also, in their endless movements in space, arranged themselves in vast patterns around still more remote centers of life and energy, until the universe and all that it contained and the vast field of space and all that it sustained went on and on forever. Always full of life, this life always patterned and orderly and proceeding and progressing according to some mysterious law beyond human comprehension. Thus the universe was populated with a race of giants. Space was inhabited by gods over gods. And all these mysterious sparks in the sky were far more than merely radiant centers of some magnetic energy or something of that nature. They were alive, and they shone because the life in them shone through. Perhaps we would interpret this life merely as a fierce combustion, but to these peoples, this life was a proof of a great power, a great force. And the light of suns was nothing but the visible nimbus around the heads of invisible gods. All of this made quite a fine and wonderful and dramatic way of looking at things. In the Buddhist Sutra, the Lotus of the True Law, another kind of solar mystery is introduced. Here, the great planetary bodies and even the great cosmic suns in the galaxies of the Milky Way, or perhaps compounded into the mysterious forms of the zodiacal constellations, all these great sparks of light in the sky were actually temples, shrines, pagodas, mysterious places of worship for great spiritual beings. Every light in the sky was a Buddha in meditation upon the infinite. And when somewhere in the great field of space another living creature, being or power, attained the infinite illumination, all these mysterious altars and shrines and pagodas in the sky winked and twinkled with approval. And their mysterious powers extending out as spiritual energies became aware of the great cosmic benefaction that this change had wrought when another soul found eternal light. So all these different symbols become quite poetic and in many regards and ways quite inspiring in the development of poetic theory, in the development of religious mystery. All of these different elements go into the general situation and pageantry of things. In the study of this same problem, we then pass on to other considerations. From Paracelsus we learn, for example, that it was the belief of the enlightened of old that every solar system is fashioned in a way like an egg. The Hindus also had the mysterious egg, which was identical with the womb of Meru. In the solar system, there are actually three centers of power, three suns, from which in the subconsciousness of man came the concept of the Trinity, or the threefold power of God, which was based upon the ancient identification of the sun with deity, an identification that is to be found in every part of the world and in almost every level of human society. Even the most primitive people have been overwhelmed by the majesty of the sun and have come nearly always to attribute the solar propensities to their principal deities. In the Paracelsian corpus, for example, the three suns represent a spiritual center which radiates the life light of God, a psychic center which radiates the life light of love or of the second logos, and a material center from which is generated the physical structure of the solar system itself. Thus it was believed in those days that the visible sun was not the source of life or light. And while it seems to be in a state of vast combustion, as suggested during eclipses when we can see the corona in the form of vast outburstings of flame, running, rising perhaps thousands of miles into space. But to the ancients, this sun, this luminous disk, was actually a reflector of light, not a source of it. Some say, as the Druids did, that it was like the reflecting or refracting lens that brought energy to a focal point, bestowing upon it the power to burn by bringing or converging the rays of light into a small area. In any event, they believed definitely that the true source of all life was in the spiritual sun, invisible, because its life is not such that men can perceive it with any sensory structure which they possess. This spiritual sun imparts its glory to the psychic or soul center of the solar system, which may be likened to the second logos, or the second person of the Neoplatonic Trinity. This second logos, or power, in turn transfers its energy or life to the third or material structure, which is therefore ensouled by two invisible sources of life. In ancient symbolism, sometimes these three suns were represented as concentric circles, one within the other, or concentric spheres. Under such condition, each of the three moved on a different inclination of axis, and the result was that the complete compound solar body was gyroscopic, capable of suspending itself in the midst of its creation simply by the mysterious equilibrium of the intermotions of its own nature or substance. This concept almost certainly was involved in the Trimurti, or the three-headed Brahma in India, and probably in the three persons of the triad in Christianity. They did represent, in the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, the three transcendent powers which are together said to be the source of all light or all life in the solar system. Now, we have many ways in which we seek to understand the structure of a solar system. Astronomy has its own ideas, and these ideas may be physically correct, and yet in no way exhaust the entire mystery of the matter. The ancients were inclined to feel that a solar system was an allotment in place. That is, somewhere in the great field of life, a solar system had a right to exist, had a right to a place in which it could grow, in which it could extend its powers, fulfill its maturity. In other words, like the optimistic human being, the solar system more or less liked to believe that it had a home, a little part of this great space in which all things exist. And like man, the solar system perhaps has only one allotment, the small square of earth in which it will be buried. But in any event, there was this space allotment. And in this space allotment, when the time came, the third logos, or the third creating power, called by the Gnostics Ildabaoth, the Lord of the Aeons, was entrusted with the power to bring forth a material world. We know, for example, in the legend of the building of Solomon's temple, that three powers, three master builders, were united in this task. Solomon, king of Israel, Hiram, king of Tyre, and a cunning workman who was brought from Tyre by King Hiram to be the overseer and master of the works, and who was to be the master builder in the perfection of the house of Solomon the king. These three, later called the three grand masters of Jerusalem, were therefore likened to the three suns in the Kabbalistic mystery, Solomon symbolizing the spiritual sun, Hiram of Tyre, the psychic sun, which furnished the materials for the temple, and finally Hiram, the son of the widow, the master builder, who was the one to fashion the outer fabric of the house of the living God. So the third logos, or creating physical power, invested with authority by the invisible powers behind it, began to make use, as Bamy expresses it, of the allotment, and did so by first of all building around the circumference of the allotment in space, the mysterious wall pass not, which was the measuring, the surveying of the allotment. William Blake therefore shows deity in the beginning of creation holding the architect's compass in his hand and drawing a great circle. This great circle became in symbolism the mysterious symbol of the sun itself, a dot in a circle, sometimes represented by the eye of Horus or an open eye in a circle. But whatever we may want to call it, the first great movement was this tracing of the circle, by the compass in the hand of the infinite. And into this allotment set aside by the tracing of the circle, it was said that the great powers began to fashion, as within the circular globe of an alchemical vessel, the mystery of the solar system. The solar system, as Plato also points out, begins therefore with the circumference and moves gradually toward the center. The wall of the solar system was what the ancient Kabbalists and mystics in the valley of the Euphrates referred to as the wall of heaven. And we find this same thought restored to us in the Apocalypse of St. John and in Muhammad's mysterious night journey to heaven. Also the story of this star descending through the seven gates of the seven worlds in the Babylonian theology. The first and most mysterious power, therefore, of this wall, as St. John points out, is that it divides the universe into, or the solar system more correctly now, into two parts. And this part, this division is suggested in the opening chapters of Genesis, when the waters which were above the heavens were divided from the waters which were beneath the heavens. Outside of the great ring, Ptolemy and the other map makers and geographers of old time assumed there to be only the spiritual universe. This spiritual universe was the abode of the heavenly hosts. Here, somewhere in space, was the eternal throne of God. Here the elders knelt before the throne, and here the Lamb stood as the eternal sacrifice to a world of relapsed lives. St. John, therefore, describes the little ladder that leads up to the wall of heaven, the door that goes through the firmament into that which is above and beyond. Outside of the ring that was set up in the allotment of space, the heavens themselves were therefore vastly diversified into three great rings, which were called the rings of the constellations. 12 of these constellations formed the zodiacal band and girdled the globe, which was to be the solar system. 12 other constellations were gathered to the north to form the stars of the northern hemisphere, and 12 others to the south, forming the constellations of the southern hemisphere. These 36 constellations, 12 in the middle boundaries, 12 to the north and 12 to the south, made up the 36 decans, or divisions of the zodiac in the philosophy of Babylon. This great zodiacal band, therefore, was really the symbol of the sovereign government of that which was above and beyond the solar system. Here the great gods sat in endless meditation upon this little bubble and all that it contained. Here were the rishi, the eternal sages, gathering to protect the mysterious power of the magnetic pole. Here was the dragon which Jason sought when he went forth in quest of the magic fleece, or the golden fleece. Here also were all the fields of mythology and all the great, strange, and incredible legendary that arose not really from the study of star groups, but from ancient concepts concerning the divine world that rested beyond the boundary of the solar system. Within this solar system itself, this allotment, this area, began to constrict from the circumference to the center. As it constricted, it left behind it seven conditions of privation, which became to the ancients orbits, or symbols of the pathways of planets. The first and most ancient being or god that was sensed to have been created by this procedure was the deity who ruled over the final extremities of solar existence. This was Cronus, ancient Saturn. He was the first of the gods, the first differentiation within the solar system. as the first to come into being, he would be the last to go. And also, in the process of the disintegration of worlds, he would devour all else that came from himself, as Saturn or Cronus is said to have devoured his children. Within the orbit of Cronus was that of Jupiter. For Jupiter overcame his own father and took over the rulership of the solar system. And Jupiter, therefore, became the emblem no longer of despotism, but of a constitutional authority. And in the descent of these orbits, if we want to study it closely enough, we will find also the emergence of all forms of government. Because each of these planetary powers ruled at one time in the dawn of things by its own arrangement. There is a chart in England, an old engraving, showing the solar system of legislation, and it is a very interesting diagram. As Saturn was a strange kind of melancholy despot, ruling by the divine right, so we find in the empire of Cronus this absolute fatality, this complete despotism. But with the coming of the empire of Jupiter, who took away the despotism of his father, we find the appearance, as in the Greek and Roman legendary, of a kindlier and more benevolent administration. Jupiter was a monarch, but not a despot. Jupiter ruled not merely for his own pleasure, but for the benefit of the governed. He became the symbol of justice, whereas Saturn, that had preceded him, was the symbol not of justice, but of tyranny. And gradually in that age, it is said, Jupiter brought forth order, and society was established upon the great foundations of a benevolent leadership. But in the course of time, the Golden Age and all that it implied gradually vanished away. And in the place of the kindly rulership of Jupiter, the solar system passed to the keeping of Mars, or Oz, the god of war. And at some time, remote conflict did arise in the world. And with the conflict of things, there were great changes. This conflict was partly due to the Promethean episode, in which men gaining a certain fire within themselves, of which Mars is a symbol, suddenly revolted against the gods and set up the tyranny of their own in the world. And in this tyranny, they began to struggle one with the other for the advantages of their own causes. And we find in several different mythologies how war and sorrow and misery so increased upon the earth, how men so departed from truth and principle in the ruthless exploitation of their own ambitions, that finally that God sent tempests and deluges and oblivions and combustions and swept away the world that had failed to keep the peace. Out of the reign of Mars then came the peculiar situation that we find in ancient astronomy. For in this arrangement, the sun is placed next in an orbit. So the world passed to the keeping of Helios, the sun god, the Apollo. And in this is implied that the world passed to the keeping of a light, of a refulgence, of a beauty. For with the rising of the solar orbit in the ancient philosophy, the world became inwardly and outwardly illumined. It was then that the visible sun, as we know it in the sky, actually came into existence as a condition or a quality of light. Then it was also that its great symbol, the light of mind, or the light of reason, came. Then it was that man was some way strangely divided from his pre-Adamite kind. It was then that some mysterious creature, which had this humanity always locked within it, suddenly revealed something of its human estate. The eyes of the mind were opened, and the eyes of light began to contemplate a universe by means of the light of intelligence. Then in the course of time, out of this dawning individuality, this rise of the sense of selfness, there came another phenomenon, and that was the rulership passed to the next orbit, that of Venus. And in the orbit of Venus, we have the world's tremendous unfoldment, first in the emotional pressures of life, and secondly in the flowering of great arts, the arriving of beauty as a force or power in the imagination of creation. Thus, artistry, creative self-expression, the urge to reveal or release the soul through advancements of all kinds of creativity emerged. And there was a second cycle of war, for in this case, Athena, which is closely related to this pattern, is accredited with having given to the world armament and the art of weaving, two widely diversified things. Also in this came the mysteries of ambition and the strange psychic passions and animal instincts which have later come to be so powerful. After this, the next orbit of the planets arrived in its proper and due sequence, and we had the orbit of Mercury, and the world was turned over to the rule of the intellect. Here, mind began to take over all others' considerations. The light of reason passed into darkness, and in its place was the dim candle flicker of thought, of intelligence as we know it. Everything then became a matter of formulas, of terms and words. With the coming of the orbit of Mercury, Cadmus is said to have invented the alphabets, and all the writings and readings of mankind. The sciences came into being, and all other forms of exact knowledge. And Mercury became the symbol of formal education, the rise of philosophic systems, the motion of man also gradually and inevitably towards the sciences. In the ancient concepts of things, the next orbit was given to the moon. And the moon was held as having a true orbit, which we do not recognize today. But in the old geocentric system, the reason for the moon, moon's place is very obvious and important. The moon became the symbol of illusion and delusion. It also became an emblem of self-deceit. Perhaps, however, more originally, and in line with the older concepts of things, the moon was associated with the power of precipitating lives from an invisible to a visible state. The moon, therefore, was the gateway of generations. The moon provided the mysterious humid element by means of which souls in a free state were drawn toward body. And it was because of the power of the moon and the mysterious cycles which it exercises, and its still recognized influence on the cycles of fecundity, that the moon is said to have provided the gateway for invisible souls to enter into the earth. Therefore, in that time and under those conditions, not only did the embodiments come, but the embodied creatures ruled by the moon were ruled by a reflected light and not a true light. And the government of the moon was strangely the government of physical instinct based upon the procreative pressure in living things. All of these together, the seven, then caused their energies and powers to center upon the common receptacle of such energies and powers, and that was the earth. And because men thought in terms of their own habitation and of the effect of all these mysteries upon themselves, having no way to interpret, except to interpret, as these various influences affected their own existence, we know that man, psychologically, can only live in a geocentric system of existence, or perhaps we might call it an egocentric, or a human-centered system, because this is all he knows. This is the only experience which he is capable of having. In any event, into the cup, the open cup of the earth, poured all these influences. And these influences not only sent their rays and forces downward, but each ray carried a seed power within itself. And all the planets of the solar system above were reflected under the surface of the earth to become orders of minerals, orders of gems, orders of energy and magnetism, orders of substances and chemicals. They also gradually sprang out of the earth again as orders of plants and animals and living creatures. And everywhere within creatures, these seven again repeated themselves in the rising of sensory perceptions, in the release of powers, in the building of organisms, each of which was a septenary structure in itself. And from this we have the whole great pattern of septenaries, which, due to the divisions within them, also provided the law of octaves. Actually, having thus brought everything to bear into the great center of things, we find, as Empedocles points out, that actually in the last we have man. Man himself, in whom the universe and the solar system are epitomized. Man who has received his body from the planets, his soul from the stars. We have man himself, in whose nature all of these forces are symbolically or actually present. We find man who, suffering from the disease of one planet, is cured by the remedy provided by a planet of contrary quality. Here we find also that the sensory perceptions are tied to the stars, the fates of men, to the motions of heavenly bodies. Thus, this whole strange, wonderful system seemed to come into existence. And in so doing, it established also the relations of worship. It showed the structures of religions, how the faiths of men were engendered and sustained. For each planet set up its own religion in its own time in the cycles of the world. Some of these religions have continued, others have vanished away. But where they have vanished in form, their energies have continued in new appearances. We have in all of these different patterns the endless operation of a law of similars, of all things sympathetically affecting other things of the same qualities. All things, by their natures and forms, based upon one great design, the Platonic archetype that was so well sensed and appreciated by Leonardo da Vinci. Architecture, all the different branches of human life, arise of specializations within these areas. From these same planets and their mysteries, the Hindus developed his doctrine of chakras and spiritual centers, came to find the keys to his great systems of yoga and Vedanta. From the same systems also came all the elaborate imagery of Tibet, Mongolia, and Korea, and China, and Japan. All these patterns work together, forming out of the solar system one design, infinitely repeating itself. Repeating itself in gradually descending magnitudes, but always consistent by what the ancients called a process of concatenation, in which things descend in likeness from themselves, decreasing in size, perhaps increasing in number, but always the mystery of one, if solved, will reveal all the others. Also, by this same law of mysteries, only one life is carried throughout this entire structure. And where the smallest atom or the tiniest structure in nature to actually cease, then the entire universe would fail on its foundation. And this ancient concept seems to have a little bearing on our modern researches in nuclear fission. Nuclear fission is only a manifestation of the incredible energy potential that is locked within the smallest divisions or units of substance. This reveals perhaps more rapidly and clearly than any other way that the entire energy of space is captured in each of the seeds which are sown in space, and that the reason why the fission of the atom is possible is because all growth is finally a fission of atoms. It is a gradual release of cosmic energy until the smallest, by normal and legitimate growth, unfolding all of its potentials far beyond anything conceivable in a nuclear fission today, that each seed contains within itself the potential of a total cosmos. This would be quite consistent with the old position and may yet have some fascination for modern thinkers. As the universe and the solar systems that make it up moves in its endless march across the great fields of space, another interesting point is presented, namely that growth has to be according to this ladder of John or this ladder of Muhammad. Evolution is the motion again from the center to the circumference. When all the great energies in the field set aside for the solar system were condensed, drawn together, or centered in the form of the physical sun, this sun became a vast compression of the energy that had otherwise been diversified over a large area. The moment this compression was perfected or completed, the visible or luminous body of the sun appeared. But from that moment on, when involution or the compression process moving toward the center was changed to the great evolutionary cycle, at that moment the sun's rays began to move out again over the area which had previously been deprived, so that the release of the sun back again to the original state of diffused, equally distributed energy is part of the reason for this great radiance that we ascribe to the solar activity. In other words, the sun, moving back over the area which has been deprived, is bringing to life or nourishing all these units which have to slumber or rest until the sun's energy is reversed by the great tide of cosmic process. The ancients thought this all out. Perhaps they were ambitious, perhaps they were audacious. But in any event, they had a big idea. They had an idea that certainly transcends our common interpretation of things. In the development of this same concept, the sun became more and more identified with the essential characteristics of man himself. Just as the solar system had its sun, so every man must have his sun, must have his light. And one of the three great centers in man must correspond to this light. In the old system, the analogies were variously made according to the abilities of the people. The three suns in the human body were represented by the three principal centers in man: the heart, the mind, and the reproductive focus. The third, or visible sun, was associated with the reproductive system. The second, or psychic sun, was associated with the brain. And the great central sun, the spiritual sun, was associated with the heart. The heart was therefore the true giver of life and sustained the other two suns by its own spiritual energy. Some of the alchemists had another arrangement, however, in which they showed the heart as a triple sun, much following the Gnostic and earlier beliefs, making the heart, again, a kind of gyroscopic center in which the three suns had their actual abode, and the mental focus in the brain and the physical focus in the reproductive system were reflexes of this central sun. This returns also in your northern Buddhistic school, where the spiritual sun, Amida, is represented by the two reflexes which are essential expressions, Kannon and Seishi, one representing the psychic life of the individual and the other representing the generative power indicated by the thunderbolt carried by Seishi. In any event, a triad was set up. And in this triad, one energy within man was divided, as in the solar system, to sustain and nourish three different types of growth, or different types of energy. Actually, according to the old Hindus, there is another interesting point. Namely, that the solar system, with all this elaborate process going on in it, and these processes are innumerable and are not in conflict with each other, that the solar system truly represents a great womb, a great place for the prenatal development of suns. Therefore, that actually, to use an old Hindu statement, only the sun itself is born. The planets are embryos. These embryos actually signify unborn suns. Therefore, each one of them is attached to the solar center by an invisible magnetic umbilicus, which enters each of the planets itself magnetically at the North Pole and provides the luminance or energy necessary to maintain the planet. Each of the planets, therefore, is in a prenatal state, nursed by the sun, and will remain in this state until it is born, at which time its magnetic field will reverse in the same way as the circulation of the blood in the embryo. In this also, the fact that the planets are not born is carried on as a thought further into the Hindu cosmogony. In the magnetic fields of the planets, five magnetic fields are recognized or identified. These magnetic fields surround each one of the planets. But by means of a little trick in mathematics, these magnetic fields have been increased in number to seven by dividing two of them in half. That is, into an upper and lower level, as in the case in man of the emotional nature, which is described as the higher and lower emotions, and the mental nature described as the higher and lower mind. But actually, this is something of a subterfuge, because the complete septenary is only symbolically implied. In the ancient system, each planet has five magnetic fields, the sun providing the sixth and seventh, so that actually there are only five separate bodies for planets, magnetic or invisible bodies. And the sixth and seventh bodies have not been individualized, and they remain part of the magnetic field of the sun. It is when the sixth and seventh body have been identified or individualized that the planet is actually born and becomes a sun. Until then, it depends for its life and nutrition upon the solar center. All this is also referred to and discussed in the great symbol systems of antiquity. And for instance, we know that in Buddhism, the five Dhyana Buddhas are recognized, the five great spiritual meditating lords. But the sixth and seventh, though known to exist esoterically, are not listed or are not revealed. These represent the two powers of life in an evolving planet that have yet to be individualized from the solar body. Man also has the power of a septenary of sensation, seven senses, but only five of these have been individualized, the other two belonging to the psychic field of the planet itself. Thus, everywhere in the present state of mankind, all septenaries consist of five operating and two suspended powers. This is because they all go back to the solar system with its five individualized and two unindividualized essences. What is the ultimate power of a solar system to be understood as consisting of? In the ancient times, Plato, many others, referred to the solar system as the divine animal. The Chinese have a very good idea of this. The solar system is a being. The solar system is alive. And the solar system is the peculiar deity ruling over everything that exists within it. Therefore, the basic nature of a religion must be associated to the nature of the creation evolving in a solar system.